Hello and welcome to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Streit, and Men's Magazines focuses on the arts, culture, commentary, and in-depth news reporting is found in both the domestic and the international editions of GQ, Esquire, and Men's Health. In this edition, for the third week of November 2024, as the country continues to recover from one of our wilder elections ever, with half of us high and half low, Men's Magazines will once again pursue a common grounding topic which unites and heals like no other. Music. Music, thank God for music. Last week it was Beyoncé and Afrobeats star Atiz. This week it's Irish rockers Fontaines D.C. and those loud, dark, edgy, and oddly thoughtful Americans Nine Inch Nails. Can either group make rock bands cool again? GQ asks. Well, I'll read and you can come to your own conclusions. Before we begin, though, I must mention that Men's Magazines includes adult content and, on occasion, language which some might find offensive. Having said that, I encourage you to sit back, relax, and enjoy Men's Magazines. With their anarchic sound, freaky aesthetic, and celebrity fans, Cillian Murphy, Harry Styles, Paul Mescal, Irish band Fontaines D.C. are already your favorite artist's favorite artist. Their new album reaches for mainstream domination. Can these guys make rock bands cool again? By Olivia Ovenden. When Fontaines D.C. were living in Dublin and making their first album, Doggerel, the five band members would pile into drummer Tom Cole's car and blast their freshly recorded songs through the speakers. This took some work. The car was so old that they had to connect their phones to an FM converter to create their own radio station, which the sound system could then tune in. The band's debut opens with a furious, hypnotic chant. Dublin in the rain is mine, a pregnant city with a Catholic mind. Before doubling down on that sense of entitlement, my childhood was small, but I'm going to be big. They would drive along one bank of the Liffey, the river that runs through the Irish capital, and back down the opposite side, playing the songs over and over again, a defiant unit closed off from the outside world. We were driving in a square, really, really high on our own genius, singer Grian Chatton says now, deadpan. The system was so bad you couldn't tell that the demos were really bad. It was 2018. They had just got an agent, signed their first record deal, and quit their jobs. But beneath the outward bravado, there was some self-awareness. After guitarist Connor Curley handed in his notice, he went to the cafe where his girlfriend worked to tell her the news. She said she was quitting too. I was like, oh no, you should definitely keep your job. It is the humid crush of mid-August, the week before the release of Fontaine's fourth album, Romance, and I've come to meet the band in Charleville-Mézières, a small town that sits between France's Champagne region and the Belgian border. They're in town for Le Cabaret Vert, a festival they first played back in 2018. Three appearances here, and as many albums later, they are now near the top of the bill. This particular performance comes in the middle of a seismic wave that has carried the band from cult status, they're your favorite artist, to the cusp of something much bigger. After a slow burn ascent, a Grammy nomination in 2021, a Brit Award in 2023, Fontaines are everywhere. In Andrea Arnold's film Bird, released this month, in which Barry Keoghan sings their track, A Hero's Death, menacingly, on Jimmy Fallon, launching Starbuster, the first single for the album, at the cover shoot for this issue, at which Paul Mescal said Fontaines were all he was listening to right now. They get into your brain and never really leave, Mescal told GQ. It feels like that success is cresting right at this very moment, and they make a straggled arrival on the riverbank in Charleville-Mézières, dressed in a riot of leopard print neon sunglasses and Adidas tracksuits. Cole and guitarist Carlos O'Connell first, and then Chatton, bassist Connor Deegan the third, Deego always, and Curly bring up the rear. Fontaine's ascent is all the more unlikely, coming as it does at a time when the all-male guitar band seems like an endangered species. So far, not a single band has topped the Billboard Hot 100 this year. In our era of outsized pop personalities, earnest country boys, and culture-eating rap beefs, indie rock bands feel like relics from another decade. The few that have found relevance have done so by trying to break the mold of their predecessors, Boy Genius, or by their wry, parodic approach, the 1975. Fontaines have thrived as something else entirely, a furious punk rock outfit taking aim at society's ills via Chatton's snarling, spoken, shouted vocals, ragged guitar chords, and the thunderclap of Cole's driving drums. Even as Fontaines are finally getting their flowers, they're already in the midst of another rebellion. For their new album, Romance, the band went to war with the image of themselves, pushing a new, softer sound, one that aches with its frustrations and pain rather than yelling it in your face. At the same time, the band have undergone a radical makeover, eschewing their previous go-tos of cardigans, jeans, and leather jackets for outfits that include skirts and knee-high socks, as well as slicked hair in the style of natural-born killers. The new music is more approachable, more mainstream. It also risks putting off the fans that got them there. They don't care. You can't arrest our development for the sake of people who get misty-eyed when they hear our first record, says Chatton. The decision they were faced with, says Deego, was obvious. Do we go this conventional safe route to keep plugging away, or do we actually just go for the bold thing and be brave? The five members of Fontaines met at BIM Music College in Dublin. The DC stands for Dublin City. There, they bonded over a shared love of writers like Yeats and Joyce, and in 2014 formed a band, playing dingy venues and self-releasing a run of singles. In May 2018, shortly before graduating, the band signed their first record deal with Partisan. There was a proper excitement surrounding them from the beginning, the actor Cillian Murphy, another Fontaines fan, told me. I remember thinking the lyrics were something special when I heard them. And the energy. I saw them for the first time play in Dublin in 2019, and already there was a devotion to the band in the audience. They met that expectation and blew the roof off. In those early days, Chatton and Curly lived together in a derelict house where the back wall was missing. If you walked far enough down the hall, you'd be outside. The pair would lie in bed together, reading Romance by the 19th-century French poet Arthur Rimbaud. It is only now, as we're talking, that they make the connection to the new album. Reading Romance in bed, smoking cigarettes. I was the Verlaine to your Rimbaud, Chatton says, referencing the poet's clandestine lover. I only like you as a friend, man, Curly replies. France in August has a hungover, rueful quality to it. The shops have shut for the month. Upturned in the river beside where we meet is a rowboat with the Paris 2024 Olympics logo on its belly. Rimbaud was born and lived here in Charleville-Mézières, and the town seems to be in its own kind of permanent mourning. There are Rimbaud motels and bookshops and barbers. Bars offer a refreshing bottle of Cola d'Arthur, with his likeness on the label. The first time the band played the festival here in 2018, the five of them bought matching Rimbaud t-shirts and wore them on stage. It was a momentary lapse in our desire to be cool, says Chatton. Each time they return, the band visit Rimbaud's house, which has been preserved as a museum. We walk around in silence, reading Rimbaud's poems on the walls. At one point, Chatton reverently strokes a bit of plaster. In the courtyard outside, O'Connell, the guitarist, whose pink and yellow hair is gelled into droopy spikes, is reading a verse from the Rimbaud coffee table book he bought in the gift shop. I am back in Charleville. I am dying. I am rotting. In the dullness, in the meanness, in the grayness, he delivers somberly, and then starts to laugh. The lad loved this town. He loved it. As a group, they are intense and unexpectedly earnest, trading inside jokes, but just as often wading deep into poetry or art with the depth of feeling that is almost awkward to be on the outside of. The first question Grian ever asked me was, "What book are you reading?" James Ford, the producer who worked on Romance, says, "They're very serious. They're not fucking around." The introduction to the book that O'Connell is quoting was written by Patti Smith, a hero of theirs. O'Connell recalls an encounter he and Digo had with Smith when she came to Trinity College to speak in 2016. "Me and Digo went to the induction day at Trinity and just pretended we were students," O'Connell says. Not only did they make it into the talk, but O'Connell ended up presenting Smith with a book of Yeats's poetry. He'd spent all his money on it and written a note inside to her. Smith was moved, he says, telling him that Yeats was the first poet she ever read. She told him that as a young girl, her father recited Yeats's work and she would go around quoting him. "Tread softly, because you tread on my dreams." After Doggerel and the acclaim that followed, Fontaine's D.C. found both critics and listeners grouping them together with the British acts Shame and Idols, describing their music as post-punk. In hindsight, the association makes sense. The three bands captured an angry, anti-establishment tide that a sanitized, pop-saturated music industry had been sorely lacking. But post-punk never really fit how they felt about their music. Okay, maybe for a few weeks before they finished writing Doggerel, Chatton concedes, but with their subsequent albums, A Hero's Death from 2020 and Skinty Fia 2022, their management encouraged them to pick the punkier-sounding songs as singles to appear consistent with that early impression. I'd be lying if I said it didn't affect me, insofar as it made me want to prove that we weren't that, Chatton says. With each record, we've basically said, there's no way they can call this a punk record or a post-punk record, and they always fucking do. I think if you still, he breaks off, not you, someone, thinks we sound like Idols or Shame, they're just not listening. Fontaine's early records captured vividly a feeling of revolt, whether against the English. Fan favorite Boys in the Better Land is about a taxi driver embracing his inner Irishness by shouting, "Brits out!" or their disillusionment at the old Ireland slipping away to gentrification. Do they miss Dublin? The band is now largely based in London. Like as much as people who live there miss Dublin, Chatton says. Romance represents a different kind of resistance. From the box the band found themselves stuffed into, and the relentless end-times mood of the moment. I think as the world becomes more and more apparently and inescapably troubled, the more the idea of romance and escapism become really intriguing to me, says Chatton, his eyes shifting behind his red sunglasses. We've left the Rimbaud Museum and are sitting in the town's central square, which feels like a Disneyland recreation of a French town, complete with a carousel. We sit and wait for a puppet show. Some of the band order half beers. O'Connell helps me order a gin and tonic by confidently saying "gin tonic" in a drawl that has been honed in the company of his French partner. There is no moment where someone is not either rolling or smoking a cigarette. Chatton talks about romance as a lineup of caricatures or parodies, little vignettes of emotion. It is an album of contrasts, the lush escapism of tracks like In the Modern World, interrupted by songs of fury and anxiety. On Starbuster, written after a panic attack Chatton had at London's St. Pancras Station, the kick drum beat arrives like a foot in your chest. When the band performed it live, Chatton holds the mic up to the crowd, loudly draws in his breath, and you hear an unsettling wheeze as thousands gasp for air. You have to listen carefully to hear the traces of the old Fontaines. Ford, who has previously worked with Blur and with the Arctic Monkeys on their striking Direction Change album AM, came on board for Romance after seeing how excited the band were to do something different. "I could see that they were looking to pull the tablecloth and shake it all up," he tells me. Ford encouraged them to do everything more quietly, to bring out different textures and emotions in the music. There are certain records where you make them and think, "I know this is going to go down well." I ask Digo how much they write with an awareness of what their fans want. To our left, O'Connell is striking the side of his pint glass and trying to get Curly and Cole to sing the exact note produced. Bee! The people whose opinions I really care about are these lads here and our manager Trevor, says Digo. "If they like it, we know it's good." See? "It's D, man," O'Connell says, holding up a keyboard app on his phone to show them. D. "They're not doing a good job of proving it now," Digo says quietly, "but I do really value them." The next morning, as we sit in the conference room of their hotel, it's clear the band have no idea they are days away from some of the best reviews of any album this year. Two coffees arrive from their manager for Chatton, who couldn't sleep last night. The others make small talk, which doesn't suit the intensity and earnestness that they normally carry around with them. When they perform, there's barely more than a delayed hello. The idea of fans feeling betrayed by their new sound irks them, as though they aren't allowed to evolve. "If they were actively engaged with our music, they wouldn't really care. They'd be really excited about us changing these things," says Chatton. The strong reaction among fans is mirrored in the response to their style shakeup, which feels as significant to the band's intentions as the album. "At some point, I started to think we should be as intentional about our clothes as we are about the music," says O'Connell, who was the driving force behind their new dress sense. "You can have a museum full of amazing art, but if it's put in a building that looks like nothing, you might walk past." He references Rosalia as an artist totally in command of their aesthetic and using it to tell a story. Chatton is a big fan of Korn and recalls the impact of their terrifying outfits as much as the music. Digo slips in wearing a green vintage-style soccer shirt with his blonde hair in bunches on his head, and then they really get going. "Music has become more and more about acquiring material you can wear on your Spotify Wrapped," Chatton says. "We're just completely disinterested in that. When it changes, people get upset because it's not the subscription they started listening to 2 years ago." Digo says that a swath of the band's older macho fans are now embarrassed to be seen liking a band that wears skirts and photo shoots. "You do see comments like that ignorant kind of stuff," he says. "They're wrong-like." Railing against an enemy seems to be when Fontaines are at their most formidable and, sorry guys, their most punk. O'Connell: "I feel really strongly about how strict rock and roll has become. It feels like total bullshit. There's nothing radical about it for me. I think we are kind of doing that a bit, and some people are explicitly pissed off, you know? They can't comprehend our clothes. The only way they can comprehend it is coming up with a theory that we've been forced into it." Digo: "There was a magazine cover where people were like, 'Grian has been chosen,' because it looked like he had two horns, like it was the Illuminati." Curly: "Wait, you're in the Illuminati? When did they ask you to join?" Digo: "You never check your emails." As much as making romance was a scary departure for the band, it also felt like a return to where they started, the very beginning of what would become the album is its final song, Favorite, with its jangling guitar intro reminiscent of The Cure. The track started with a chord progression that O'Connell played to Chatton while they were recording their 2022 album, Skintifia. It was a new sound for them, but it had the flavor of bands they used to love, like the Lemonheads and the Lahs. O'Connell had just moved into an apartment in London on his own for the first time. The band coined the term apartment rock to describe the feeling it gave them. It's like movie songs you hear, and you instantly imagine you're living in an apartment in New York with exposed brick and have really good friends that you hang out with all the time, O'Connell says dreamily. Yeah, it's like these are the good times, Chatton says. Nostalgia for now. On their tour bus supporting the Arctic Monkeys across North America last year, Chatton was continually rewriting the lyrics to get them just right. Whenever they were in a car together, they played it over and over, now without the need to make a pirate radio station to hear it back. It felt like it had all the chemistry of Fontaine's getting together in a room and playing a song, O'Connell says. It just became our joy. That camaraderie is something for a band to hold on to, a source of confidence in the face of resistance, and kinship at times of onrushing change. Ford saw the same kind of insular brotherhood in the Arctic Monkeys, one that everyone wants in on. It's like you're trying to get into the group, and no one ever really will, he says. The us against the world thing is very powerful. I think about that idea when Chatton talks about In the Modern World, another song on romance, inspired by a very cinematic, very Fontaine's idea of a throuple at the end of time. The way he explains it, it sounds as much like the song could be their own origin story. It's like an agreement to escape together, he says. A week later, the night before Romance is released, Fontaine's DC play the Electric Ballroom, a 1,500-capacity venue in Camden in North London. Outside, a crowd is waiting in hope of getting in, while someone walks up and down the queue of ticket holders repeating, "You don't know how lucky you are." Inside, the grinning faces know this might be the last time they'll ever see the band play a venue this small. Watching over from either side of the balcony are Murphy and Harry Styles. When the band appears, it is as though the magnitude of the moment hasn't reached the stage. They open with a sinister, creeping bass line, and Chatton waits a beat before he starts singing the album's opening lyrics. "Into the darkness again, the five of them, and the rest of the world." And that concludes Can These Guys Make Rock Bands Cool Again? By Olivia Ovenden. And it sounds like Fontaine's DC may just manage it. Okay, and now we're on to our second article. Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, best friends and Nine Inch Nails bandmates, found unlikely creative fulfillment and a couple of Oscars by reassessing what they had to offer as musicians. And now they're thinking even bigger and imagining an artistic empire of their own making. Dark Kingdom by Zach Barron. Every weekday, Trent Reznor makes his way from his house, a cottagey sprawl behind a white wall in a canyon on Los Angeles's west side, to a studio he's built in his backyard. There, he meets his best friend, bandmate, and business partner, Atticus Ross, and they get to work. Reznor and Ross observe the same hours, Monday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. "We show up," Reznor told me. "We're not late. We're not coming in to start to fuck around." It's a methodical, orderly existence that Reznor could not have foreseen in the 90s when he was fronting Nine Inch Nails and struggling with a drug and alcohol problem that was his answer to success. "I would do anything to avoid writing a song," Reznor said. "I'd rewire the studio 50 times." Now, Reznor has a wife, Mary Queen Mondig, five kids, and multiple jobs. He is sober, Since 2010, when the director David Fincher asked Reznor and Ross to score The Social Network, for which Reznor and Ross won an Oscar, the two men have had steady employment composing for film. This year, Reznor and Ross are also starting a yet-to-be-named company built around storytelling in multiple disciplines. Film production, fashion, a music festival, and a venture with Epic Games. And then, of course, there is the oldest and perhaps still the most complicated of Reznor's jobs, being the frontman of Nine Inch Nails. In 1988, Reznor formed what was then a one-man band. The first two full-length records Nine Inch Nails released, Pretty Hate Machine in 1989 and The Downward Spiral 1994, have sold more than 8 million copies. Over subsequent years and subsequent albums, the band has since crossed the 20 million mark in sales. In the 90s, for a time, Nine Inch Nails were ubiquitous, a phenomenon on the level of Nirvana or Dr. Dre. During that decade, the success of the band nearly killed Reznor. "I didn't feel prepared to process how disorienting that was," he said, "how much it can distort your personality." These days, Nine Inch Nails, which Ross joined as a full-time member in 2016, present a different problem. How do you make something old, something so already well-defined, new again? There are years when Reznor feels like he has the answers and years when he's less certain. He has put the band on hiatus more than once. After the last Nine Inch Nails tour in 2022, Reznor deliberately took a break from playing shows as well. "For the first time in a long time, I wasn't sure. What's the tour going to say?" Reznor told me. "What do I have to say right now? We can still play those songs real good, and maybe we can come up with a new production, but it wasn't screaming at me, 'This is what to do right now.'" But he and Ross still come to work, daily, in search of transcendence. "We sit in here every day," Reznor said, "and a portion of the time organically becomes us just figuring out who we are as people and processing life and a kind of therapy session. And in those endless hours, it's come up, why do we want to do this? And the reason is because we both feel the most in touch with God and fulfilled. It is easy to make things when you are a teenager growing up in rural Pennsylvania, near the Ohio border, as Reznor was, and you have nothing to lose and everything to gain. It is considerably harder once you've gotten older and found a way to make things that people like to keep going. It's an old story. The act of creation can lift you up, but those sharp gifts can also destroy you, and if you make it past that, the sheer blissful regularity of life with money and a family can even you out so thoroughly that there is no friction left to work with. You look inside the cupboard, and the cupboard is bare." And we must pause here for station identification. You're listening to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. And now back to our piece on Nine Inch Nails. Or it's a mansion, and living inside of it is a person you're bored of. And so you stop looking. But Reznor and Ross have never stopped looking, and the search for that magical feeling of finding something, that feeling of, in Reznor's words, "I don't know where it came from. I don't know how I just did what I did, but I've channeled it into something that worked," is still the thing that organizes their days and their moods. We are talking in their studio, which was low-lit and cold and full of synthesizers blinking lights. Reznor was on a couch and Ross sat in a chair nearby. The two men first met in the 90s when Reznor signed Ross's band, 12 Rounds, to Reznor's Nothing Records. Soon after, they became friends and then musical collaborators. "I was just getting sober," Reznor said, "and I was in a pretty fragile transitional phase. And I just hit it off with Atticus right off the bat, and part of it was he was someone who was on much firmer ground, in a mentory kind of way, than I was." Ross is 2 years younger than Reznor, but when they met, he'd already been through certain things Reznor was just getting around to. "I got clean when I was very young," Ross told me. "So I had a bit more experience than him. Put it like this, I knew you could have fun without being high." Their friendship has been a constant in both their lives since. "I don't know if Parts of us are broken and we don't feel good enough, Reznor said, staring at the ceiling of the studio. But we know if we work as hard as we can and do the best work we can, it fixes something. At the core of it, that's what unites us creatively. On top of that, I think his take on the world and his role in life helps me understand my place and not feel as detached in some ways. Reznor often jokes or simply explains that he is a quart low on whatever it is that makes people happy. I think we can both, on our own devices, run below zero as a baseline, Reznor said. I don't mean manic depression, I just mean we don't take compliments well. It's like when we won the Oscar, it was the day after. Let's take today guilt-free, kind of say, fuck yeah, and tomorrow we'll have settled back down to a few feet below sea level. In their years of collaborating with each other, both men have found some mutual reassurance, a little lift. Reznor gestured at Ross. I remember something he said to me, and I don't know if you want me to say this or not, in one of our talks years ago. Here's what I want today. I see what's coming, Ross said nervously. I just want to feel okay, Reznor said, quoting his friend. I want to feel like I'm okay. One day this past winter, Reznor greeted me at the door of their studio. In the course of reporting this story, I never saw him anywhere else, wearing a black hoodie made by the synthesizer company Moog, black jeans and black running shoes. At 58, Reznor still retains the angular intensity and jet black hair of his youth, but time and fatherhood seem to have made him quicker to smile. He looks a little like a college professor now, or an unusually well-cared-for software engineer. He led me back past walls of unused gear and several black-clad mannequins, all of which startled me, to their primary workspace where Ross, a tall West Londoner with a stern face and a pleasantly reedy voice, sat at a computer, also all in black. Once I asked the two men whether their upcoming clothing line would feature any color. No, Reznor said incredulously, of course not. They were on deadline for two films at the moment, including Luca Guadagnino's forthcoming Queer. But we're trying not to work, Reznor said dryly. Leaned up against one wall was a photo of the two in tuxedos accepting the Academy Award for Best Original Score for their work on The Social Network. Reznor had contributed to soundtracks before in the 90s, but he'd never formally scored a film until The Social Network. But Reznor and Ross quickly realized that the work, in some ways, wasn't so different from songwriting. What do we do when we write a song? Reznor asked. We're trying to emotionally connect with somebody. Take the Mark Zuckerberg character in The Social Network. Here's somebody who thinks this idea is so important that it's worth kind of fucking your friends over for it, and then realizing maybe it wasn't worth it, or I didn't realize how I'd feel if I got what I wanted at the price of this. I can relate to that in my own language. Suddenly, there's music. And Reznor found that he enjoyed the exercise of solving someone else's problems instead of his own. There's something about not being the boss and working again in service to something that I initially felt guilty for, feeling kind of fulfilled by, and in a weird way. Reznor said that on another Fincher film, Mank, the director suggested, what if it sounded like maybe inspired by Bernard Ehrman, and as if it were recorded in 1935, and this film canister sat on the shelf for 60 years? Okay, interesting. Ross and Reznor were nominated for that one, too. On the first film the two men scored for Guadagnino, Bones and All, we got a cut of that was nearly 4 hours long with no music, and we kind of thought, oh, fuck, Reznor said. 4 hours we sat without a pee break, transfixed. It didn't need music. And when you watch that, you approach it differently. Then Guadagnino brought them Challengers, which will be released this month. Reznor said, he started us down a path saying, what if it was very loud techno music through the whole film? This is exactly what it turned out to be. I wish I had had his notes, Ross said of Guadagnino. His notes were so fucking funny on what each piece was meant to do. Oh yeah, Reznor said. Unending homoerotic desire. It was all a variation on those three words. They liked the challenge of scoring, they found, and that feeling of not being in control. They also liked the way it made them crave being in control again. It makes you more inspired to work on other stuff when you're finished, Reznor said, even if it's just, thank God it's done now, and we can appreciate the freedom we had before we gave it up. These days, Reznor and Ross also like having jobs that let them be at home, around their families. Both men had tumultuous or lonely lives when they were younger, and both men have found that fatherhood soothes certain unresolved aspects of their pasts. Ross has three kids, and probably the greatest reward is how balanced and happy they all are compared to, certainly, my growing up as an unusual sort of scenario. It was a fairly chaotic youth. Ross comes from a notable English family, but his immediate lineage was more unstable. My dad had a club called Flipper's Roller Boogie Palace here in L.A. in the 70s, Ross told me. He went bankrupt in England and had a judgment passed against him where he couldn't talk to a bank manager for 15 years. So he moved here and opened up this sort of Studio 54 on roller skates on La Cienega in Santa Monica. Ross held up a coffee table book full of photos of the club. You don't need to look at it, but it was just a mad life. So I grew up in some madness. It is particularly endearing to see Reznor, who at a distance was a fierce and terrifying figure in his 20s and 30s, find domestic bliss. I am old enough that my adolescence coincided neatly with the S&M-flavored, I-want-to-fuck-you-like-an-animal era of Nine Inch Nails. When I was leaving Reznor's house one day, I noted with some amusement the cheerful mundanity of a basketball hoop in the backyard. I'm grateful not to be as angry and frustrated and desperate as I have felt in the past, Reznor told me. I couldn't have predicted that there was a world where I would have a sizable family with kids and feel the level of fulfillment and comfort and be able to live in that. What was something you were consciously seeking before you found it? I think I had some abandonment issues from my parents splitting up or feeling I never fit in, and I'd gotten accustomed to being on my own, and largely due to my own, I think, inability to really be intimate with people or share or be open or know how to be a friend or a partner to somebody. Trying that out and doing it with pure and full immersion has led to an unexpectedly great outcome. The other film project Reznor and Ross were on deadline for was Scott Derrickson's The Gorge, a sci-fi thriller starring Miles Teller and Anna Taylor-Joy. They were working on a lengthy, music-dependent scene that they'd already mostly scored, but Ross said, the director wants it to be a bit more, I can't think of a better word than just a bit more scary and intense. They weren't sure what that directive meant, exactly, but they were content and they were happy to try to figure it out. To enter the room once again, carrying nothing, and to try to leave with something that didn't exist before. Ross called up the scene on a monitor at the center of a long mixing board, Teller and Taylor-Joy in an evil-looking spiky forest. Reznor and Ross have somewhat fluid roles in their collaboration, but today the plan was for Reznor to improvise some music while Ross edited and manipulated it in real time. Atticus's superpower, Reznor said, is that I can come up with a melody and a chord change, and he can make it sit on the scene in a way that is meticulous and mind-numbingly boring to watch him do. A studio assistant, also in all black, presented himself to help Reznor set up a microphone and a cello next to a keyboard that sat underneath another computer monitor. Ross hit play on the footage and what they'd already completed of the score, a kind of haunted, chanting murmur. It's basically atmosphere at the moment, Ross said. Next to him was a synthesizer whose make and model he asked me not to print, and which the two men use as a kind of sound ecosystem to feed stuff into. Reznor began by pushing down on the piano's keyboard, while with his other hand he manipulated the sound with a flat synthesizer on the desk in front of him. It began as a kind of mellow pan flute thing, and then, with a push of a few buttons, became more of a sad, social, networkish plonk. Ross stood up and started tapping the synthesizer to his left, and the sounds Reznor made began to loop and accumulate, little melodic figures that plunged in and out of feedback. Reznor moved from the piano to the microphone, where he sang a few soft passages in a baritone falsetto, more sad than spooky, and then to the cello, which he bowed slowly and choppily. Ross moved between the computer and the synthesizer, trying to harness it all as it built to a loud, echoing crescendo. After about 20 minutes, Reznor sat back in his chair, and Ross soon followed suit. Everything got quiet again. "It's going fishing," Reznor said to me, shrugging. "Sometimes something happens." "Or sometimes everything happens. One of the first things you see when you arrive at Reznor's home studio are two original paintings by the artist Russell Mills. On the left, a razor against a rusty red background. On the right, a decaying yellow and black collage that ultimately became the insert and the cover art for Nine Inch Nails' The Downward Spiral. This is the record with Hurt and Closer on it. It's an album Reznor nearly didn't survive." Why do I bring this up? Well, if I may, for a moment, sound like the aging dude in a black t-shirt leaning against the back wall of a bar where you're just trying to be young and free of recitations of what the year 1994 felt like, there was a different quality to the way things would happen in music. Bands would labor for years, unknown, and then just get struck by lightning, is the best way I can put it. One day, you're just a guy, and then one radio station plays your song, and then every radio station plays your song, and everyone is listening to those radio stations, because there is nothing else to do, and then MTV loops your video, and everyone watches it, because again, there is nothing else to do, and all of a sudden, you are known by millions of bored people in a way that doesn't quite happen now. This is a gross oversimplification, of course, but here Reznor is, one of the very few people who have experienced the thing I'm describing. I thought, let's just ask him what it was like. Reznor said, okay, he could tell me exactly what it felt like. He gave me a single moment. Woodstock 94, which Nine Inch Nails almost didn't play. It seemed like it was going to be gross, to be honest with you, but ultimately did. And when we got there, it was terrifying, Reznor said. It was way bigger than I pictured in my head, and walking on stage, but this is the point of the story, I knew. You could feel like you were in the right place at the right time. In retrospect, how did you handle success? Had a drink. That's what sent me down the path. I wasn't the guy that, you know, at 12 years old, cracked a beer. That wasn't it at all. Just, I feel anxious around people. I'm not sure how to act, especially now that you're someone that's supposed to act a certain way. There's a projection. It feels uncomfortable to walk down the street and people are looking at you because they recognize you. That's weird. Suddenly, everybody wants to be your friend, and you're the coolest. Everyone wants to date you and shit like that. Reznor said he found it was easier to have a beer before I go in that room. And then a couple of beers before I go in that room. And pretty soon, over a period of time, wait a minute, things start to get out of control, and you know how the story goes. Here's how the story went. Reznor began to wonder if Trent Reznor could ever live up to the Nine Inch Nails guy that people had in their head. The reason I was having to drink was to fix that problem, my own insecurity. But the net result is, I'm not really who I am because now I've got drugs or alcohol in my system and I'm not thinking as who I really am. And that comes into focus once one gets sober and has time to reflect and kind of think about what got you there and the shit you did. Eventually, Reznor got sober and built himself back up. Today he's happy to talk about all of it, obviously, but he and Ross have done a lot together since. 10 albums worth of Nine Inch Nails. Ross was an official member of the band for 5 of them, among other things. And Reznor is, by nature, not one to dwell too much on the past of a band that he's still very much trying to figure out. We're not fans of resting on laurels. We've been afraid of thinking about nostalgia. That's a whole other conversation, but the reality is we're getting older, and our fans are getting older, and that's a fact. And I think, say, during the pandemic, not that you asked this question, but as I'm sure everybody was, I was pretty genuinely freaked out and very clearly came into focus. I've got to protect my family. He was consumed by fear, by terror of what might happen, of what he might do about it. I can't even fit all my kids in a car, Reznor said. But in the midst of that anxiety, sitting alone in here, I found comfort in nostalgia. I found comfort looking back at things from my youth that I've been afraid to even allow myself to glimpse at because it meant artistic death. Because one has to look forward. One can't be self-referential. I was so afraid growing up in a little shitty town. I could see people that thought the highlight of their life is junior in high school catching the football. You know what I mean? That's it. That was the peak. I don't want to fucking be that person. I could see my fate if I stayed in that town. In those moments, sitting by yourself, what were you getting nostalgic for? I miss parts of living in Pennsylvania. I miss a simpler life that I grew up with. I really loved the first NXS album in 1983. I was a senior in high school, and when I listened to it now, I could almost start crying because it fucking reminds me of driving in a shitty fucking car in the summer in Pennsylvania. You know what I mean? Man, I allowed myself to kind of immerse myself in who I was at that time and what it felt like. Reznor had been trying to remake himself ever since he left where he grew up, and now here he is in Los Angeles over 40 years later. And I kind of went on a deep dive for a while, and I allowed myself to realize I am who I am, and the things that made me weren't the cool things. I'd always been ashamed of. I came from a shitty town. I didn't have an exotic upbringing. Shitty education. You know what I mean? That's who I am. I am not sure what the point of all that confession was. Well, except it plays into where I'm at now. The last time I saw Reznor and Ross, it was once again in their studio, and they were sitting very still. Had they been working before I got there? We were for a little bit, Ross said, and then nervously thinking about you arriving. Really? It's okay if that's the truth. That's the truth, Reznor said. They'd just been in this room for the past weeks, months, years, really, he said, head down, working. He gestured at me. It's a different mindset. And I was thinking about something you said the other day, Reznor said. That was on a Friday. I'd asked a somewhat rude question about their soundtrack work, which was, why would Reznor or Ross work for anyone else when they didn't have to? And now it was Monday. I thought about that over the weekend, Reznor said. It's like, why are we doing this? The idea comes from what we think is a good place of let's break it up. Let's get sent down the rabbit hole on certain things and feel like we've got tasks being assigned to us rather than us just blindly seeing what happens creatively. But, he said, I think coming out of a stretch of a number of films in a row, I want some time of seeing where the wind blows versus there's a looming date on a calendar coming up and we better get our shit together. And certainly in the last few weeks, I've been itching to do what we often do, which is just come in and let's start something that we're not even sure what it's for. Some of that energy, he and Ross said, would probably become the next Nine Inch Nails album. Doing soundtrack work, Reznor said, had managed to make Nine Inch Nails feel way more exciting than it had been in the past few years. I'd kind of let it atrophy a bit in my mind for a variety of reasons. But now, I do feel excited about starting on the next record, Ross said. I think we're in a place now where we kind of have an idea. And then there was the company, which Reznor and Ross spent the last 2 years putting together, piece by piece, with the help of John Crawford, their longtime art director, and the producer, Jonathan Pavesi. The idea was, what could they do that they hadn't already done around storytelling? And some of that might take the form of examining Nine Inch Nails from yet another angle. We've been working on homegrown IP around Nine Inch Nails, stories we could tell, and we're working on developing those in a way that are not what you'd think they'd be, as in, not a biopic. They also have a show in development with Christopher Storer, the creator of The Bear, they said, and a film with the veteran horror director Mike Flanagan. Reznor put on a pair of black-rimmed glasses so that he could examine a piece of paper next to him. We just wrote some notes because I knew I'd forget what the fuck I'm about to say. And there was a short film coming with the artist Suzanne Deacon. And there was a clothing venture, a t-shirt line made in collaboration with a notable designer whose name they'd like to keep secret for now, which will arrive this summer. There was a music festival that they were currently planning, where we're going to debut as performing as composers along with a roster of other interesting people, and a record label, both scheduled to launch around the same time. And for 2 years, they've been working with Epic Games on something that is not exactly a video game in the UEFN ecosystem Epic has built around Fortnite. It's what Zuckerberg was trying to bullshit us into calling the metaverse, Reznor said. You can't say that word anymore, but in the terms of the toolkit, thinking about it through the lens of what could be possible for artists and experiences, we thought that would be an interesting way to tell a story through that. They were nervously contemplating the prospect of having day jobs again, of being responsible for more than just themselves. Early on, as they contemplated launching the company, they'd sat down with David Fincher to ask him about movie production. How does it work? And he's like, oh, you're fucked, Reznor said. I can distill a 2-hour conversation into that. Because he said, I know you guys, and no one's going to care more than you do, and you will not be able to let it go. Reznor has actually had this experience before of being sucked into a project bigger than Nine Inch Nails and having it take over his entire life. Years ago, he worked as an executive, first for Beats and then for Apple, building a streaming music service. Trent was very clear when we started, Ross said, we cannot let this get into Apple terrain. Reznor laughed. What I mean by that is, I will make this brief. I'm trying to think through what I'm about to talk shit on, just to self-censor for a second. Reznor paused for a moment and then explained. For years, he said, he'd wondered, what would make a good streaming service? And this was before the advent of Spotify in the U.S. or Apple Music. Jimmy Iovine, Reznor's old label boss, later Iovine would also become Ross's brother-in-law after he married Ross's sister Liberty in 2016, was launching a music service at Beats, which was then acquired by Apple, and Iovine said to Reznor, come try to make this thing a reality, and Reznor surprised himself by saying yes. It was a unique opportunity to work at the biggest company in the world at a high level, Reznor said, and it was interesting, the scale of the people that you reach through those platforms. Just the global amount of influence those platforms can have was exciting. The political situation I was dropped into was not as exciting. Reznor enjoyed working with Apple's design team and its engineering team, but it made me realize how much I want to be an artist first and foremost. Reznor also became discouraged with the possibility of fixing the problem that he was trying to solve. I think the terrible payout of streaming services has mortally wounded a whole tier of artists that make being an artist unsustainable. And it's great if you're Drake, and it's not great if you're Grizzly Bear. And the reality is, take a look around. We've had enough time for the whole all the boats rise argument to see they don't all rise. Those boats rise. These boats don't. They can't make money in any means. And I think that's bad for art. And I thought maybe at Apple there could be influence to pay in a more fair or significant way, because a lot of those services are just a rounding error compared to what comes in elsewhere, unlike Spotify, where their whole business is that. But that's tied to a lot of other political things and label issues, and everyone's trying to hold onto their little piece of the pie, and it is what it is. I also realize, I think that people just want to turn the faucet on and have music come in. They're not really concerned about all the romantic shit I thought mattered. Anyway, Reznor said, turning to Ross, that was a long-winded way of saying, when we talked about this company, I just said, be aware of what success might look like, because it will turn into something that eats up lots of cycles and time and attention and energy. But Ross said taking on new responsibilities was paradoxically also a way to stay a little younger. I know we've all been talking about being dads and being adults and all that, Ross said, and there is a part of me that thinks it's important to keep the kid alive, meaning the kid inside yourself, rather than the one you're responsible for. Oh, the drummer is drumming, and that means another hour has flown past here at Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Streit, and I have enjoyed reading these music-based articles for you on the Irish band Fontaines D.C., and on the founders of Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. Oh, I hope you found some pleasure in it too, and maybe a little inspiration about keeping that inner child alive, keeping some joy alive, however you make it, however you find it. Between now and next week, keep up that good work. Take care of yourself. Take care of one another. Peace.